You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including Grants Pass and other stories. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, environment, and energy reporter.
Reporter Jane Vaughn is off today, but we'll start with this conversation we recorded with her yesterday. Jane, the city of Grants Pass is finalizing a $1.2 million grant to give out. What is that for?
It is for addressing the city's homelessness crisis. So as I've reported on before, Grants Pass has faced a really increasingly visible homelessness problem in recent years and a couple of lawsuits over it. The most recent lawsuit was dismissed in August after the city has agreed to provide a resting space for 150 people. It has to be within the urban growth boundary of the city for 1 year. And then there are other stipulations. It has to be low barrier. It has to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. So the goal of this program is to pick an organization and give them $1.2 million for them to shelter 150 homeless people and basically take that burden off of the city. The city currently has a few unmanaged homeless campsites downtown that are city-owned, and so this project would allow them to close those sites and have a new managed site elsewhere. And so the city council had a meeting on Monday. They interviewed applicants and they chose a group called Pathways to Stability to give them the grant. And so it's a newish group and it's led by people who are involved with a lot of other local groups like U-Turn for Christ, which is a drug and alcohol counseling group, PATH, which is a social services organization. And so Pathways' plan for this project is to have what they call a stabilization center. They say the site will be staffed 24 hours a day. There'll be security, fencing. They'll have case management, support services, and it has to be a low-barrier shelter. So there's minimal entry requirements, but there will be rules like no weapons, no drugs, things like that. So that is their vision for this site.
And Jane, this grant process has been a little complicated. Can you give us some background on what's gone on there?
Yeah, it has been. So it's been a long process. So the first round of trying to award this grant was canceled after the applicant that had been chosen to receive the grant withdrew its application. So the city had to issue a whole new RFP and start all over again. This time, they got four applicants. The city council voted at their meeting on Monday to disqualify one of them for failing to meet program requirements. And then they actually also considered disqualifying Pathways, which is the group that eventually got the grant, over alleged improper communication with the mayor. They ultimately decided not to disqualify them. And so they interviewed the three remaining applicants, picked Pathways. But another sort of trick to all of this is that—
Wait, it's not easy cruising from here?
It's not. It's not. There's another twist. The piece of land that Pathways wants to use to put its program on is owned by the county, so they haven't secured it yet. Some of the Grants Pass city councilors on Monday were really concerned about that. Like, what if they don't get the land? What if we have to start all over again? Should we be giving the grant to Pathways when they don't have the land? And obviously they decided to do so anyway, but it was a 6-2 vote, so it was not unanimous.
So what happens now?
That's a great question. That is to be determined. The Josephine County Board of Commissioners had a meeting on Thursday about this. A lot of people spoke during public comment. Some of them really supported this plan. They like Pathways. They trust the people in charge. They feel like the city really needs a solution to this problem, and we need a site, and, you know, they should go for it. And then some people were really against it. They don't like this site. It's near schools. It's near an apartment complex. They say it'll bring down property values. They're saying it's risking kids' safety. Earlier this month, the Grants Pass School Board did actually ask the city council to identify a different location for this project. But the county commissioners haven't made a decision. One commissioner said he's exploring another potential parcel of land as an option. He didn't give that many details, but they haven't decided whether or not to actually lease this land to Pathways. But the clock is really kind of ticking to make a decision. Pathways would need to have its program up and running 6 months after receiving the grant. And the Grants Pass City Council is supposed to consider the contract to award the grant to Pathways on November 5th, which is coming right up. So that might change depending on negotiations with the county, but it's kind of a tight timeline, so we'll have to see what they decide.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Jane. I'm sure we'll hear more about this.
You will. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. That was JPR's Jane Vaughn. And Justin, you reported on the effects of the federal shutdown on forestry work in our area. What kind of work are we talking about here?
Yeah, so this includes like tree planting, fuels reduction, tree thinning, pile burning, wildfire mitigation sort of in general. So all the non-timber harvesting type of work that goes on in our region. And like I've reported before, this work is largely done by contractors who rely on foreign workers. Jackson County is actually a nationwide center for this industry, and millions of dollars of federal contracts for this work flow through this county. So we like to report on how changes at the federal level are generally impacting these businesses. And I called a lot of them. I, you know, spent quite a lot of time going through a list of contractors before I finally got someone on the phone. And I spoke with someone at DL Reforestation. They're based in Jackson County. And they said the shutdown has basically stopped their work. So federal inspectors can't visit their project areas to kind of sign off on the work they've done. And the owner is waiting on, at this point, hundreds of thousands of dollars in payments from the federal government for this work.
Which affects not just him, but his workers, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, fall is a pretty important time for a lot of this work. Is that right?
Right. So in fall, you know, fire restrictions have ended, so you can operate chainsaws and do pile burns. The winter snows haven't yet arrived, so there is this limited window in a lot of Oregon for this type of work. You know, with DL Reforestation, they've paused actually a large fuels reduction project in Northern California, and he said, the owner of this company said, if the government shutdown continues, they'll miss that pre-winter window to work in this area. The snows will come and they'll have to basically wait until next year. The owner also says he has around 40 employees. And like I mentioned, they're foreign guest workers. They're here for just a limited amount of time per the rules of their visa to make money. And he's not been able to pay them. So he said, you know, if the shutdown doesn't end by next week, he'll probably, you know, need to let these workers go, or these workers will find work elsewhere.
Well, not all forestry work is stopped, though. Is that right?
Right. So it's not everything. And if you live in the Rogue Valley, you might have seen, you know, some of this work since the shutdown and you know, pile burns and things like that. I reached out to the Oregon Department of Forestry, and they said in a statement that payment delays are varied depending on the federal agency and the funding source. So national forest contracts seem to still be going forward. The USDA is funding projects they deem a priority, which includes wildfire mitigation. State, private, and tribal forestry awards are still continuing. But Bureau of Land Management payments have stopped, and that's what's affected, for example, DL Reforestation, that contractor. And, you know, even when these projects are still funded, there has been delays and this general sense of uncertainty about whether or not you will get money from the federal government. And so that's made it harder for these contractors to plan.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting to see how wide-reaching these effects can be.
Yeah.
Roman, you reported on funding for naloxone vending machines in Shasta County. What happened there?
So this week, county supervisors approved using opioid settlement funding that they've received from lawsuits against drug manufacturers to install 6 naloxone vending machines around the country. So for those who don't know, naloxone, otherwise known as Narcan, is a drug that can reverse opioid overdoses, basically saving someone's life. So these machines are going to cost around $160,000 total, which they're using that settlement funding for. The funding will cover the machines for around 3 years, and then supervisors voted 4-1 to approve that funding this week.
So why is Shasta County installing these machines?
Yeah, the idea comes from the county public health department. You know, they've been obviously looking for different ways to help deal with opioid overdoses in the county, which have become a big problem, not just in Shasta County, but, you know, all over the country. I know that 24 other counties are also rolling out their own vending machines in California, and I believe a lot of states are also doing the same thing. You know, this drug is really good because it can save someone's life and give them enough time to get to the hospital for treatment. It's not just, you know, for people who might be abusing these drugs. You know, sometimes you might not know if you're taking a drug, if it has fentanyl in it, if you might not have gotten it from a pharmacy or something. So it can be really easy to overdose on fentanyl as well. So these machines would allow people to get, you know, free naloxone to have on hand for emergencies when something like that
and
happens.
It's really the harm reduction model, I think.
Yeah. It's ensuring that, you know, people don't overdose and die, basically.
Yeah,
it's making sure that they have access.
They have time to get into treatment, even.
Yeah.
Well, how are these vending machines going to work? Do I put a quarter in?
I actually don't know the full details about exactly how the vending machines are going to work and what they're going to look like, but I do know that they're going to be installed in some strategic locations like the county jail, the community health center, the Good News Rescue Mission, a homeless shelter. So they're all going to be in kind of places where someone might already be getting support for opioid abuse. You know, they're also going to use tablets, iPads, they said, that are going to be able to collect data. So I assume people might be entering in some information in there to get, you know, a box. And then they'll be able to analyze their impact of these machines. So, you know, they're going to be installed in some cities, but not everywhere in the county. They'll be able to see if they reduce, you know, opioid deaths in the area that they're installed. The county also got a $10,000 grant to run a media campaign to promote these machines and, you know, get people to understand that they exist and that they can use them. And then they're going to be maintained and refilled by the Shasta Substance Use Coalition. So that's kind of what we know so far, but we don't know the full details exactly of how these machines will work, but I do know that it's going to be free access to these.
Yeah. So no quarters needed. Yes. It sounds like there were some concerns from county supervisors. What did you hear about that?
Yeah, so there was a little bit of controversy in the meeting, and that's partly why I ended up doing a story about it. Mainly the concerns came from board chair Kevin Cry. He was like adamantly opposed to these machines, very against them. He was never going to support them. He's really worried that teenagers essentially will have unfettered access to this drug and that they can just get naloxone whenever they want, and that that will then incentivize them to take opioids because they won't have to worry about an overdose, that they can just take opioids, have an overdose, take naloxone, and then take more opioids.
But like naloxone isn't something you'd take just to get high.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you have to take opioids. The naloxone will prevent you from dying, essentially, if you overdose on opioids. But county staff obviously disputed a lot of those claims. You know, naloxone essentially causes rapid opioid withdrawal, which is not fun, they said. You know, that someone who receives naloxone are going to be really mad when they come to. They will not be happy. They're going to feel really crappy. So it's not like you would just take naloxone, come back to normal, and then you can go back to taking opioids again. You know, it's also not like a magic cure. It basically blocks opioid receptors in the body, but it is only temporary. It lasts about 30 to 90 minutes. So, you know, if the opioids you're taking have a half-life that's longer than that, you could overdose again once that weans off. So you have to keep taking it. So really, you should be calling for an ambulance and going to the hospital, you know, if you have an overdose. The machines are also going to be in really specific locations. They'll be monitored, and they're going to be in places where people can get help. You know, some supervisors said they're not just, you know, teens are not just going to casually go to the county jail or the homeless shelter to get naloxone. This is also supported by a lot of groups, the sheriff, you know, tribes, you know, other groups. So, you know, Cry had said he would be happier just getting a pallet of the stuff and handing it out at an event. But some supervisors noted that, you know, these machines are helpful for people who might not be comfortable going to an event where they're handing out naloxone, especially if your county supervisor is giving it to you. you know, so Supervisor Corky Harmon was on the fence about it during the meeting. They needed 4 out of the 5 votes to approve it, but the other supervisors were able to convince him to support the project. So we'll probably see these up in Shasta in the near future.
Okay, well, thanks, Roman. Justin, you also reported on some new funds going to Humboldt County for mental health services. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is some good news. So this week, California State Senator Mike McGuire announced $75 million in state and county funding will go to the county for mental health crisis facilities, which is a, you know, big amount of money for this rural area. That money will be used to build a new 20-bed inpatient psychiatric center in Eureka. That'll open in 2030 and replace the 58-year-old Semper Virens health facility there. The Mad River Crisis Triage Center in Arcata is also getting $5.5 million for a 43-bed facility. And the Sorrel Leaf Healing Center in Eureka will also open the region's first, actually, Children's Crisis Residential Program. They're getting $750,000 in funding. And that program, it sounds pretty cool. It'll be located on a 13-acre therapeutic farm.
And those mental health beds really seem needed almost everywhere, it seems like, has a shortage. How many new beds for crisis care is the county getting?
Yeah, so total Humboldt County will now have 101 beds used for this type of crisis care, which officials have said is really important, because right now a lot of people in this mental health crisis are being lodged in jail or in emergency rooms. So this takes pressure off of local authorities and local hospitals.
Thanks, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for the things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.